Recording in progress.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to our Thursday evening session. I came across a quote recently from the American writer Bell Hooks, who is a Buddhist practitioner, I think with Thich Nhat Hanh, actually, in that tradition. And it spoke to me, and I thought it spoke to our moment in the world today and to any moment in our lives, but particularly today, in this crazy place we're in with upheaval and disruption and disorientation, and a profound absence of love in the public sphere, or at least anything that reflects deep love. So she said, she wrote, "There is no change without contemplation. The whole image of Buddha under the Bodhi tree says, here is an action taking place that may not appear to be a meaningful action." And isn't that the case? You know, sometimes we say, wow, why are we sitting? What are we doing? There's so much strife and poverty and violence and discrimination in the world. We should be doing something. We should not just sit on our cushions. Or even if we're not even saying that, we kind of relegate our sitting practice to the second sphere of our life, or the third or the fourth or the fifth sphere. It's something that we do when we have nothing else to do, or we squeeze it in between other things. And maybe because we don't have this sense of it being a meaningful action, you know, if we really saw the meaning, like Bell Hooks points out, and the change that can arise from that, we know just from the image of the Buddha that his and his story, that change, a radical change occurred in his being, in his life. He suddenly saw everything as if he had been, as if it had turned right side up, as if he had been looking at it upside down, or backwards or something. He saw the unity. He saw the unity in the difference. So he saw many beings, but he saw that they were one. And he saw what was the origin of our struggle in life, this constant focus on separation and on wanting things to be a different way. And therefore, because we don't see who we truly are, we don't truly see the unity of our being, then everything becomes unraveled. Our experience of life then becomes something completely different. It becomes one of separation, of difference, of discrimination, of, you know, cruelty, of grasping, of consuming. Everything we see displayed before our eyes every moment in our world today. But it was the same thing in Buddha's time, 2,500 years ago. It just manifested differently, but it was the same thing, same things at work. And this is what he saw, and this is what he then, just by sitting there under the Bodhi tree, as she says, he realized this. However, it took what in the Zen tradition we call great faith, great doubt, and great determination for him to realize that. It wasn't like he just sat down for an hour by the river under the tree and then suddenly he saw this. He had spent years and years of trying other techniques, other practices. He had been questioning what drove him to leave his life as it was and seek what something else, was that he had this deep questioning about, well, what is death, what is old age, and what is sickness, and why do we suffer? And so he went out and looked. So it wasn't just some kind of casual undertaking to sit down under the tree. In the Zen, like I said, we call it great faith, great doubt, and great determination, which are the three, you know, we always talk about three treasures, the relative and the absolute, and the transcending of the relative and the absolute. It's always in threes, the three jewels, greed, anger, and ignorance, the three poisons. So these are the three pillars, kind of, we could say. I'm taking that term from that book, but that's not what he's referring to in the book, I don't think. I have never read the book, The Three Pillars of Zen, so I can't tell you. But let's say that great faith, great doubt, and great determination are really the pillars, foundations for our practice. Great faith being let's say it's the faith that a faith the faith in our let's say in our in Zen we would call it Buddha nature. The Tibetans would call it basic goodness. We could say essential being, true self, awakened nature. When we, those of you who have done Jukai, you know that we say that you are acknowledging with that, taking that step, making those, that commitment, you are acknowledging that your nature is awakened. It may not be your experience moment to moment, but you have faith that that's what it is. And you have faith in that that's, you know, maybe it's a step too far to say that's everybody's nature, but at least you have faith in yours. Even though, as I say, you don't experience that moment to moment. And you have faith in this way that tells us you are the way. The way is not outside of you. The path is not somewhere else. It's not, there's not some God out there. There's not some, you know, savior that's going to make your life beautiful and wonderful and eternally happy. We may like to think that, but we have faith. You know, we've heard teachers, we've seen other people, we've seen people on this way, and we see, they're onto something. You know, we can see how they behave. We say, yeah, something resonates for me there. And then we have faith in whatever it is that resonates. That's what we talk about great. That's what great faith is in this context. Now, great doubt, you know, it's not, you know, I'm completely, I have no idea what anything is. I'm confused. It's doubting entirely. Great in this context is from the Sanskrit maha, which is, you know, big, vast, beyond compare, you know, unsurpassable. It's not better or worse. It's just that it's enormous, huge, beyond our concept of big, even. So great doubt is so big that it encompasses everything, meaning that there are no certainties that we're hanging on to. No certitudes, no, you know, positions. We're set in such deep doubt that none of that even arises. I've told this story before. When I was a young teacher, I had a moment of, let's say, little doubt, but it felt big. Because, it wasn't working. I didn't have many students around me. Nobody was really interested. Like I've said, Portugal was, not happening. And I did a retreat, a New Year retreat, and I think three people came. And one of them was two young parents who shared their cushion. So it was like, like nobody was there. And I was just so discouraged and convinced, I had no self belief, no self esteem. And I was thinking, oh, forget it. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do it. And I went to this big retreat with my teacher's teacher, and there were like 300 people there. And he, so everybody was kind of like, well, what's the matter with Amy? And my teacher was like, well, what's wrong with you? And he was like, well, what's wrong with her? And trying to come up with solutions of things I should do. And none of which were satisfying. It was like, because I'm a writer, write a history of the lineage or something. And I'm like, that's not what I want to do, Or another one was, well, why don't you move back to the United States and start a sangha there? And I'm like, I'm not going to do that, But he said to me, okay, you're doubting. Well, then really doubt. Like we always say, doubt that the grass is green. Doubt that that's snow on the ground. Doubt that the sun will come up. And then he said, doubt your teacher. Doubt your transmission. Doubt me. That was not hard, that one. Doubt, doubt the lineage. Doubt my Mizumi Roshi. Doubt Zen, doubt it all. Just really doubt it all. If you're going to doubt, where are you going to draw the line, right? And because I have this temperament of kind of obsessive thing, I did it. I really, and I didn't know what else to do because I was pretty desperate. I really did it, and well, I came out the other end of it. Because I was to the point where I couldn't even like stand to chant like the four vows. It like almost made me want to puke. I couldn't bow. I just, even putting on the rakusu was like, ugh. And so I really went into this deep, like doubting it all. And then, as I've told this story before, that he, Genpo, created this massive ceremony for 300 people, like kind of a mini Jukai ceremony for 300, the whole retreat, 300 people. And all the teachers there, I think there were 9 or 10 of us, had to sit up there and do the thing with the pine branch to all these people one by one, where there's all this chanting and drums, and he was bringing in Tibetan stuff with incense and all this business of like super ritual, right? And here I am sitting there with my kesa, my robes, all this. I hate all this. I'm just like dying. And then at one point, what now I would say was the key, like Martin Luther King said, the key that unlocks the door, that well, how would I say it? The key that unlocks the door to ultimate reality, that's what Martin Luther King said, is love. And so here I am, and suddenly I just meet the eyes of one of these people who's before me. I didn't know who these people were. I mean, I maybe knew a handful of them, but I didn't know who these people were kneeling before me. And I'm doing the, transferring the wisdom of the lineage with the pine branch and all this. And I just met that person's eyes, and everything, it was like the door unlocked. Everything changed in that moment. So I would say that was the love, the meeting of those eyes, there was suddenly it was love. And I realized that what had been, and I realized that I was just like this eye was just this, like a tube through which love, compassion, wisdom, all of it is passing. And Amy was like clogging up that pipe, all this time. Because she had no trust, she was like feeling hurt. Nobody was wanted to hear her teaching. Nobody wanted to come to her retreats. And she was poor little Amy, and she was blocking it all. But as soon as that key, that love arose, Amy was no longer in the way anymore. This is an example of where great doubt takes us. Okay. So I really went into the doubt. I doubted it all. Fully, completely, just doubt, 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 doubt. And because somewhere in me there was still that flame of great faith, I was able to maintain the doubt. And then the third point pillar of our practice is great determination. So determination is because you have great faith and because you have this great doubt, there's no obstacles. Your the obstacles arise when, oops, there's a certainty there. Oops, I'm separate from what I'm doing. Great doubt means to do something wholly, fully, completely, like completely sit with mu. Completely sit with your breathing. Completely do whatever it is your practice is. Right here, right now. Just completely, fully, entirely. That's great doubt. And then you do that with great determination. Nothing can stop you if you have this great doubt and this great faith. Some of the traditional Zen teachers would say, if you really have great faith, great doubt, and great determination, you'll be instantly enlightened. Well, it doesn't actually happen like that, although it does, but not really. Enlightened meaning you just I had this moment where I saw things as they are. Okay, then, later on, Amy comes back and messes things up again, but there was that moment, of seeing things as they are and awakening to this unifying principle, Martin Luther King says, of love. So then what is that? So to come back to bell hooks and this activity is that looks like it not doing anything, right? Well, it is though. If you sit with those three pillars, if then there's radical change that happens in your life. And because radical change happens in your life, it happens in the lives of the people around you. And then the radical change happens in the lives of the people around them. Of course, radical change doesn't mean, we're going to put an end to all of the world's wars. We're going to eliminate all inequalities. There will be no more oligarchs. It doesn't mean that. But it changes how we experience that. And it changes how we move and behave in the world. And that makes a difference. If everybody did it, it would be a different world. It's already a different world if you do it. But, as bell hooks also said, a spiritual life, but we're sitting here and we say we have a spiritual life. It requires conscious practice, it requires a willingness to unite what we think or experience with the way we act. We sometimes say that it's easy to awaken, it's easy to realize unity, but it's a real challenge to actualize it and manifest it in the world. That's a real challenge. Because that involves action, that involves not just sitting on your cushion. When we're sitting on our cushion, we're fully embodying it. We're completely embodying form is emptiness. We're completely embodying unity and difference. We're completely embodying the sacred, whether we realize it or not. When we stand up, we are too, but it becomes more complicated because there's so much stuff going on. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in our head when we're sitting. But it's easier to a certain extent to put it down, to just let it be, to say, oh, yeah, right. Okay. I'm not going to plan tomorrow's meal now. I'm not going to think about what I'm putting in my suitcase on Saturday now. Just this, just sitting here. So, you know, I sit here online, and as you've, many of you noticed, for some reason, when I start sitting, my cat comes. She doesn't really come and hang out on my desk most of the rest of the time. But when I start sitting, she comes and hangs out on the desk and climbs all over me and wants my attention. And so this is a challenge for me to just sit and just let it be, you know? As soon, almost as soon as, you know, the bell rings, she goes and sleeps, goes back and sleeps on her chair back there. Very strange. I haven't quite figured it out. But it's just part of what my meditation is then, you know. If I close the door and put her outside, well, she'll scratch and cry, and then I'll have that to deal with. So I decided, okay, fine, I'll just open the door and let her come in and do it, you know, fine, okay. That's just part of what my meditation is. And I enter then, I can just include that in my great doubt of completely being just with what is in that moment. You know, this sound in the street, or, you know, the sound of the neighbors, or the smell from the kitchen, or the feeling of cold feet, or whatever it is that you're experiencing, you know, innumerable sensations, thoughts, impressions, emotions, just endless. Great doubt allows us to, great faith and great doubt and great determination allow us to just be here now, fully with what is. Now, if we extend that to we get up off our cushion and we pay attention to beyond our house and our street and maybe even our, you know, city or town or neighborhood, whatever it is, to the greater world, oh boy. We have a lot of equivalent of my cat standing on my desk and bothering me during my meditation, right? A lot of stuff happening. You know, it can be like amazing, beautiful, what we think of as amazing and beautiful things. You know, we listen to a wonderful piece of music, or we have a fantastic meal, or you know, we have a meeting with someone who we haven't seen for a really long time, or we hug our child or our partner or a neighbor. Is all those are like, you know, really stuff we love. But, or and I should say, we also have the big one, Donald Trump, right? And we also have whoever, you know, we have an annoying neighbor who makes noise at 2 in the morning. Or we have, you know, a shoe that doesn't fit right. All kinds of things, too. Parasites, you know. We think of all this stuff as like it's parasiting my mind. It's encroaching on my being peace, you know. However, we come back to bell hooks and the three pillars of our practice. Can we return to the great faith, the great doubt, and the great determination in our daily lives, not only on our cushions, but in our daily lives? And see, you know, if we can. then we can see all everything that's happening as sacred activity. Because we, in great doubt, there is no profane and sacred. We have this koan that from the Hikugan Roku that says, if one raises a speck of dust, the nation flourishes. If one does not raise a speck of dust, the nation perishes. So this sounds contradictory, right? So it sounds like we want the nation to flourish, but it's telling us to raise a speck of dust. If we don't raise a speck of dust, then the nation perishes. Well, we don't want the nation to perish. However, what it's saying is that in great doubt, there is no dust, there is no nation, there is no flourishing or perishing. Where as soon as we enter with a certainty, that speck of dust, then we've created the nation, and we've created division, and we've created segregation, and we've created inequality, and we open the gate to all the differences. But if we don't, if we remain in this, if we can maintain this great doubt, not knowing, we could say, then there is no nation. There is no separation. This does not mean that there is not France and Portugal. This does not mean that there is not man or woman. This does not mean that there is not inside and outside. However, if we raise that speck of dust about those things, if we focus on those differences, well, then we open the gate instead of, so that we can say that's the key that unlocks not love, but hatred, violence, war, anxiety, strife, all of that. Whereas if we don't raise a speck of dust, that's the key that opens love, compassion, wisdom, harmony. Because as we know, it's the nations that are fighting. It's not the individual people, Like everybody always says, yeah, well, I'm not racist. I have one of my best friends is Algerian or something. You French people see this kind of stuff all the time. Already that's like, meanwhile, they're saying horrible things, saying there shouldn't be migrants and they should send these people back to their, where they came from. And, I knew a French family who had lived for several generations on and off in what in France was called Indochina and then Vietnam. And loved Vietnam, loved the culture and the food and just, amazed. But then after the Vietnam War, they had to permanently move back to France. And these people, they would use these horrible derogatory terms about Vietnamese people. There's this term in French, Nhiệt Quê, which is a really insulting term for Vietnamese people. And I would say, how can you say that? And they would say, oh, we're not racist. We're not racist, but why would you use this derogatory term about someone if you were not racist, So as soon as we start creating these differences, as soon as we raise a speck of dust, and when I say create the differences are there. That's one aspect of reality. Difference. But when we raise a speck of dust, we create difference upon difference. We focus on the difference, let's say, instead of focusing on the unity, something like that. So yeah, and Martin Luther King, who talked about this key of love, he once wrote, kind of mimicking the early Christian Paul's letter to the Corinthians, I think, something like that. He wrote this letter to American Christians saying that segregation was a blatant denial of the unity that Christ embodied. And that it destroyed, segregation destroys community, brotherhood, unity, which was what Christ embodied. And that was Christ's message. So they were Christians not being Christian. And oh boy, we know about that today, don't we? And not only, we have Buddhists who are not being Buddhist, so-called spiritual people who are not embodying the spiritual teachings that they supposedly practice and adhere to. We could say the same thing about all of us, if even people who don't have a spiritual practice, that they're denying their basic humanity and this unifying principle that underlies all of humanity. As the great David Lynch, who I've been talking about, called the unified field. So anytime we raise a speck of dust, we're denying that. The speck of dust has no place in great doubt, let's say. So if we follow bell hooks's image, the Buddha as an agent of change, that this looks like an activity that, what did I say? I'm sorry, I had the quote. It may not appear to be a meaningful action, but it is a action, place, activity, vehicle through which we can wake up to our true nature and the true nature of reality and reduce suffering in the world. And maybe this can be an in, you know, this can incite us to, if we follow those three pillars, just practice right now, here, fully, wholly, with whatever it is, and not be caught up in the despair and the darkness and the turmoil. And the confusion that is like swirling around us all the time. Maybe all of this turmoil that has arisen and is, surrounds us, in which we are, bathing, maybe it's actually, it can be, we see it as something, a great call to wake up. Can this be something that incites us to deepen our practice? Wake up, open our hearts. even if we're really, I was really attached to this image of myself as a bad Zen teacher or a worthless Zen teacher or an incompetent Zen teacher. I was really clinging to that image. But when I opened to great doubt, I had no idea where I was going with that. I wasn't doing it to get rid of it. I didn't even know. I just, okay, he says doubt. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. It wasn't even interesting. It was like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, I guess I should doubt everything. And it was, I would say it was worth it. I don't think any of us would be sitting here today if I hadn't done that. I don't know where we would be sitting, but probably not here. But it couldn't, as we say, those kinds of reflections are absolutely ridiculous because it can't be any other way. This is what is. So this is where we are. This is what is our world. This is our moment. This is our place. This is your place. This is your time. And when we sit, we experience that beyond space and time. Even if we're like waiting for that bell to ring because we are tired of sitting, there's one moment, there's a second in that where we fully accept that this is just it, and we experience that. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it again and again and again and again. So, please have great faith that, this is a meaningful activity. Maybe the most meaningful activity you could engage in. And really embrace great doubt, meaning don't let those little doubts become parasites and become attached to them. Like I was so attached to my doubt about my abilities and my value. And, engage with great determination. Don't let other, like we say, don't be led astray by misleading ways, as we say when we take our vows, Not misleading because they're wrong or bad, but misleading because they're missing the point. And if we can keep to that, then we have a chance of waking up and changing the world. So I guess I'll stop there and give you the opportunity to share, speak. I see Martin has raised his hand immediately. Hello. Hello, Martin. You can speak.
Hello. Hello, Roshi. It was a bit too quick, actually. I was still sinking in what you said. Thank you for the amazing talk. It's been really nice to join this meditation online. I've tried to join more times. It's in my schedule now. And I was just thinking about what you said, I felt very like in this meditation. At one point, I wanted to leave. I was like, okay, I feel like I should just get up and leave. Like the meditation was being uncomfortable, but more like I felt like I had to leave. Like I felt that, like, and it was very, I don't know, because what I've been doing is like, okay, I compromise myself to like, okay, I want to sit, and if I'm sitting, I have to like sit for the time that I've said I'm going to be sitting. But today it was like, there was just something of like, I want to leave, and this makes sense. Like it's okay. Like I can leave, and then tomorrow I'm gonna meditate again and whatever. But I just had this feeling of like wanting to leave. And then I didn't leave, and then I was like peaceful again. And I don't know. So basically, what I wanted to ask is related to this, and it has to do with like sometimes I can feel like life can shift very quickly, like very uncertain, like this great doubt about life somehow, like that is not always present, but now do you say it's like there's this great doubt about my life, like on a deeper sense of things can change very quickly. And so, like, it feels like a certain extent, like, the only certainty I can have is that I want to have, like, a schedule where I can practice meditation. So, like, I have a certainty in my life, which is like, okay, I'm going to sit, like, regularly. And somehow, like for me in my life, it really changes how I live, like when I'm sitting or not, like the periods that I wasn't sitting, like the last year. And just, yeah, there's that certainty. Of the sitting, and to some extent, it feels like it's the only certainty somehow. I don't know if you wanted to share about this.
Yeah, thank you. I think everyone can probably relate to some extent to this. And we come and go, everything comes and goes, and that nothing really goes or comes, but and it's important to stay with that. Whatever it is that is your faith, whatever keeps you, well, I guess part of it is your experience, right? So you, like you say, when you do it, you feel really good, you feel peaceful, and your life is different than when you don't do it. Doesn't mean it's necessarily better or worse, but it's different. And so then we can have faith in that and trust that. And when we don't do it, it doesn't mean we have to beat ourselves up, or think we're bad or something. It's just, okay, we're doing something else. And eventually we come to, well, where do I want to put my awareness, my attention, my energy, my resources? Do I want to put it to waking up, to, peace, whatever that is? Or do I want to put it into, I don't know, whatever the other stuff we do? And as you were speaking, Martine, I had this image that came of when we were going through all the pictures that we've had through the years to celebrate our 20th anniversary. There's these pictures from when you were a small boy and you were at a retreat with your parents. And I thought, wow, you're still here. Although there's been long periods where, I mean, I haven't seen you probably for 10 years, between that picture and then when you came back. And it's not even, I'm not even saying when you were a boy and you were there, you were just there because your parents brought you, But there's something that, we come and go. I have great faith, let's say, in people's practice, whether they sit daily or not. Of course, I would say, I encourage you to have a regular practice. But if you dis if people disappear for years and then come back, not only just days, or hours. What's important is that that you maintain your faith to, in some way, and your doubt and your determination, some way or another. I didn't want to embarrass you with the picture of you being a child with your parents at the retreat. I hope you didn't take it that way, but
Not at all, the other way around, though. It's very nice.
okay.
Thank you.
If I reflect on what I was saying to Martina, the there's this in this great faith, there is an element of trust, that we can we trust that this is our way, and that, even if we feel like we stray or we don't do it or something, can we trust that that too is our way? That's what the great way is. It's nothing is outside it. We chant it in our vows. The Buddha way is unsurpassable because nothing is outside the way. So everything we do is the way. And that, that's like takes great faith to be able to say that. Great doubt as well, because that means we can't say this is not the way. Everything's the way. Everything. Like when we do our Heart of Life retreats, which we haven't done since COVID, but we say, okay, so you're having doing this retreat at home, and everyone you meet during the day is doing the retreat too, because they're involved with your activity, whatever it is. They may not, they don't know they're in the retreat, but they are because you're in the retreat. So, the people in the restaurant, they're doing samu to bring you food. The people in this train with you, and you're meditating on the train, they're in the zendo with you. The world is the zendo. That's the great way. And that involves great faith, great doubt, and great determination to maintain that, to make that our practice.
Roshi, sorry. But are we like, do we have to, like, because for me it was the question of like the consciousness of this great faith and doubt and determination, like to some extent, yeah.
Well, you just it's helpful if you try to remember it from time to time. It doesn't mean you always are thinking about it. You can have like a little thing that reminds you. You can have a buzzer on your phone at noon, or you can have a regular practice moment, or you come here. You know that you can come and sit with the group. That can be a reminder. But it doesn't mean in every moment you're thinking that. No. That's like.
Yeah, because I when you said yeah, I think I also get obsessed with things, and like with the practice I can get very obsessed, and then like sometimes like I'm feeling now like I also like to kind of go more not hallucinate but just thinking about different things in life or getting obsessed with like how do you say like in tech in like kind of intellectualizing things or not quite but just because the practice is a lot about like being present being here and now but I feel like there's another side of me that is like the opposite of I don't want to be here now at all. I want to go like very into a very spacey kind of place. But in some way, I feel like that is also an exploration of the here and now because it's like I'm doing it actively somehow. Like I was kind of thinking about this a bit.
Yeah. Trust that. Trust that if it feels like when you go into the spacey, whatever, and you feel like that's an exploration, well, trust that. That's what you're. Like I often say that I felt like I had kind of a royal way because I had a job and I had kids. And so I couldn't like 24/7 be sitting on my cushion and thinking about this practice all the time. But actually, that was like the most amazing thing. And my job was as a journalist, so I was constantly, involved with all of this raising speck of dust and nations and all of this shit, but that really grounded me and helped me not. It helped my determination, I think, maybe something like that. And helped me to realize that it's all one. So the spacey stuff you look into, that's all too, that's part of it too. No. It also is valid. Especially as you say, if you know that's what you're doing with it. Maybe not all the time, but your intention is that you're exploring something with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Lisa, you were trying to say something? You want, okay.
Yeah, hi everyone. It's funny that you should bring this up. I was set with Joe Sensei last night and went for Daisan and told him about my doubts. And then we talked about trust. Trusting the practice, trusting your teacher. So it's funny that you would should bring it up. Thank you. I don't know how maha my doubt is, but it's looking into it just before a retreat. It's good. I guess probably linked, and but it's good fertile ground, let's say. But then, as you were talking about great doubt and saying all that you doubt, and you said you doubt the green grass, you doubt the sun, you that it's going to rise, you doubt everything. And I was thinking, just how deep that doubt was, and how, yeah, I was wondering, how do you go to that extent of doubt? Yeah, I guess that was my question.
Well, you don't hold anything back. You give yourself to it. And that is our liberation. What did Michel Dubois say last Roshi say last week? Something about what has to die is our narrative, so that we can be fully alive, so. And that's another way of saying what, so like my narrative about poor me had to die. But I had to give myself fully to the doubting of it, or it's not negative necessarily. That's why I like this image of great doubt as being, it's almost like not knowing. It's like not knowing. I mean, it's the same idea of including everything. So including the grass is not green as well as the grass is green. Including it all. We say this is a practice of inclusion, not exclusion. But that narrative is a tough one to let go of, and that identity and that idea is really hard to let go of. Adrien.
Hi everyone. I'm gonna try and say something or share something because as you, it's similar to your cat situation. It's like it's this idea or this feeling or thoughts have been sort of coming at me, and every time I'm like, okay, just put it aside. Maybe you can ask about it later. Right now, someone is speaking. Listen, just be with that. And every time it comes back, at me, and every time I realize that I haven't understood or heard anything of what anyone, the person that was speaking, was saying, or almost. And so it's something like like your cat situation as well. So when the cat, comes in your case, why not? Because the cat is here coming, asking for an interaction. So why not interrupt? Or so yeah, maybe that's the theme. Why would you interrupt? Because you have decided to set But why not interrupt it? Because ultimately, if my understanding, but maybe it's not about understanding, is correct, this is what all of this is about. It's about the appropriate action. And when the cat is coming, then one could think, amongst other things, that the appropriate action is to respond because it is your pet, you decided to have it, etc. It's here coming to interact, etc. But so this leads me to a whole place of complete absurdity in a way of, I don't mean to speak ill of the three treasures or anything, of course, God forbid. It's something like, because, and there is so much absurdity in this practice anyway, that we're putting so much doubt, faith, energy into it, only to come to something where to realize that we were awakened all along, or it's just about what is happening all the time. So it's just some doesn't, I mean, something completely insane almost about it. And also another aspect was crossing my mind that there is a sort of, I'm sure it's not really, so it's just my mind maybe creating this now. There's a sort of, feels like there's a sort of closed loop in here within this practice where, when if anything arises, it's part of it. So you just sort of like for as a, for as an example, if you have great doubt about what it is you're doing, don't, I mean, yeah, you can abandon your practice and then maybe, who knows, come back to it years later or something, but the answer coming from within the practice, so the teacher or the texts that we read, because it's all referring to the same thing, point back towards the practice. I don't know if that makes any sense to anyone. So almost like, and maybe that requires great faith, that you're in this washing machine and it's going around and there's a no way out, or I don't know. Anyway, that was that. Thank you for your attention. I have to put out my laundry actually, because the washing machine is finished now. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, any thoughts, please, or yeah, direction. I mean, probably the direction B will be within the loop,
Well, because yeah, you said it. It's like this loop, and there's no way out. There is no way out because there's nowhere to go. I mean, the bad news is there's no way out, but the good news is there's nowhere to go. So you're already there. And I know that that sounds like, oh, it's just like, clever thing that Zen says. You're already there. You're already it. But it's true. And it manifests as, okay, the laundry machine is finished, so I take my laundry out. And when my cat comes, I do, I know she this is some weird thing that's going on, some neurotic thing that she has when I sit. It's like, oh, I can, she's probably developed this thing where she knows I'm not going to give her my full attention. And so she comes back at it more or something. She's kind of a neurotic cat. But I do try to give her the minimum amount of attention and kind of, cajole her and try to get her to come on my lap and settle down. And she licks my hand obsessively. And so it's not like I'm not paying any attention to her. But in another moment, when it's appropriate, I do, So yes, there's no way out, but there's nowhere to go, which is great news. And it's time to stop. So you'll be able to go get your laundry momentarily. Thank you, everyone.